This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
Hey, how'd you get here?
Quit it! We're in the presence of the Pagemaster.
I know who he is. He's the guy who did all this to me.
Welcome, everybody, to Cinematica Animalia, your weekly foray into the biology of movie monsters. This week, we're going to be taking a hard handbrake turn away from movies and actually moving into books that we think should be movies and or TV shows. My name is Adam Hastick. I'm a disease ecologist at the Ben-Gurion University of the Negev here in southern Israel. Sam is also here, a climate and data scientist at, or invasive ecologist, and located in Trondheim, Norway. He's also here and definitely not allowed to talk because I said so, and not because this is a pre-record and he's not here. Libby is not here. She was unfortunately not able to make it, but I am joined by our podcast vet, Dave.
Hello.
Hi, Dave. It's good that you're here.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Now, we have one bit of news, or one news, before we start our saga on books. And I'm going to be taking this from the timesofindia.com. Now, these are not names or village names that I'm very familiar with, so forgive my pronunciation. But Ferozabad's Cute Hot Village, I'm going to read this directly from the article. Ferozabad's Cute Hot Village has become a center of attraction for its lush greenery comprising over 300 species of plants, including a 4-foot-tall sandalwood tree. This was spread over about a 5,500 square feet area. Sam, I would ask you to convert that to meters, but you're, you know, not allowed to talk. But all this was spread over the school campus, and the garden was the result of the efforts of the single school headmaster, Mohammed Shahid, who, with the help of the students, has sown and nurtured the plants that bear fruits and flowers and vegetables that are used for preparing midday meals for the children. So it's a really cool and sustainable way to bring attention to having green spaces. It's healthier. I feel like there's been work done showing that people tend to focus better or learn a lot better when there's green around. Is that right?
It's not just learning, it's living. There's actually a new wave of green architecture that has, I mean, obviously there is green as an eco-friendly, but there's green architecture in which architects are starting to incorporate more natural light and plants actually inside spaces because people are generally happier when surrounded by sky and green.
I think you're right. And to your point about eco-architecture versus eco-building, we are currently living in an eco-building, and while it is nice to not have to use a lot of power and we are being environmentally friendly, I think I'd rather settle for the eco-living with green all around instead of having to live in a house that is 80 plus degrees during the day because we're not using AC, but hey, you take some, you lose some.
Give a little bit, sweat a lot.
Sweat a whole lot.
It's too hot today.
This week, I thought it would only be appropriate to share some literature trivia.
Literature, books. I see where you're going with this.
So, my trivia is, and I'm going to ask you, Adam, what is the earliest example of written literature to appear in the world?
The only thing I know is that one of the oldest stories ever written, I don't know if it's the very first, is the Epic of Gilgamesh.
So close. That is correct. It is the oldest known fictional story, is the Epic of Gilgamesh, which, for those of you who don't know, is a mythic poem that first appears as early as the 3rd millennium BCE, an adventure-filled tale that centers on a king named Gilgamesh. Who knows why his mother named him that?
Was this set on Gilgamesh's island?
Yeah, so king described as being one-third man, two-thirds god. So basically an early version of the boys. Mm-hmm. And he goes on a hero's journey that sees him slaying monsters, networking with other gods, and searching for the key to immortality.
What third of him is man?
That's a great question.
Maybe the ears.
I'm gonna guess elbows down.
Okay. So
just the forearms.
Okay.
But the earliest example of written literature was in the Sumerian civilization, which first developed writing around 3400 BCE, when they began making markings on clay tablets in a script known as cuneiform.
Cuneiform.
Their text usually consisted of economic and administrative documents. Boring. Ooh. But by the 3rd millennium BCE, the scribes were also copying down essays, hymns, poetries, and myths. Two of their oldest known literary works are Kesh Temple Hymn, and the Instructions of Shurupak.
Cool.
Both which existed in written versions dating around 2500 BCE.
It's pretty sweet. Speaking of tablets, onto the books.
Think, boy. What kind of an adventure would you have had if I'd brought you here with a turn of the page?
Before we get started on our literary explorations, if you've got any thoughts or questions, you can find Adam and I on Twitter. I am at BigDrFishboy. Adam is at HasekAdam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can visit cinematica.animalia.com. I just realized that I've been saying our website and then cinematicaanimalia.com as if it was something else. Like it's a fucking store in downtown Des Moines in Iowa or something like that. Like who the... If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can visit cinematicaanimalia.com or email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. You can also find us on Discord. You can find the link to our server in the episode description or at the website. If you want to read Libby's work, you can visit shortstorysoup.substack.com and read an unending swath of short stories. And if you want to hear about some of the less movie-related ecology that Adam and I write about on a regular basis, you can check out ecologyforthemasses.com. And as always, if you've got the time, tell a friend about the podcast if you're enjoying it, or leave us an in-app rating, preferably with 5 stars. So, Adam, I believe you are kicking things off today.
Yes, so...
I get it? Kicking things off because it's a football book?
Oh, that was a touchdown of a joke.
Yeah.
It wasn't well received.
So we're
going
to be touching on... two people that are really big fans of American football just throwing all their words in there.
Yeah. Tight end.
Don't talk about me like that, Sam. We're recording. Actually, no. Talk about me more like that.
I was going to say,
recording.
You like it.
Yeah.
So if you couldn't figure out from the myriad of terrible comments and jokes, my series relates to American football or gridiron, depending on where you are in the world and what you call it. In the U.S., we just call it football. Yeah, so written by a friend of the show, Scott Sigler. This is a series that is set in, quote, our world, but it's 500 years in the future. So in this universe that Scott has created, we have humans and then the 4 other primary species, at least in the first book, and you get more as you go on. But the main ones we're concerned with are the humans, the heavy G, which are humans that have been genetically engineered to live on a high-gravity world. So they're built a lot more like gorillas, at least the male heavy G are. You have the Ki, which are 12 to 14 foot long or 3 to 5 meter long centipede alligator slug snake creatures. They are quite large, and they're very strong and very scary. There are the Quith, which are somewhat like an insect is the closest thing, but they're also about the size of a very, very, very large human. And you have the Sklorno, which are...
my favorite.
9 to 12 feet tall, so 3 to 4 meters tall. They're very fast, very long legs. A nightmare.
Exclusively
of a
female.
In the football,
well,
they are.
That morph is. Yeah.
The football players are exclusively female, yes. And all of these are... they play American football, the human game American football. And it works because each one of these species has unique physiological gifts, talents, and or specialities, which makes them perfect for an ideal position on the field of American football. The main character is, and the one you'll be following for the entire series, is a character called Quentin Barnes.
Quentin Barnes!
As the Scorner would say, yes. Thank you. Quentin Barnes is a absolute brick shithouse of a human being. He's about 7 feet. He is exactly 7 feet tall, which is 2.3 meters. He weighs about 400 pounds, so 150, 170 kilograms. He's very strong, he's very fast, and he's very football.
If you've read the Infected trilogy, exact same main character.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, there are common themes in Scott Sigler's works, and sometimes that means common characters. But yeah, it focuses on Quentin's journey as the leader of a football team in a backwater world that is very much an allegory for conservative Christians, and he eventually goes on a journey to try to lead a intergalactic and interspecies team to the Galactic Championship. And it starts out focusing on football, and it eventually moves on to much bigger, wider-ranging galaxy-affecting things, including crime, war, and some romance.
Yeah, one of the things I really like about this is, well, let's say two things. We discussed during Lilo and Stitch how boring it is to just constantly have humanoids or very similar humanoids as your other species and just say that they're different. Like Doctor Who is a stickler for this, but having said that,
Star Trek.
Doctor Who's got the tiny budget. Yeah, Star Trek as well. Yeah, just paint them another color and it'll be fine. Yeah. But I like that there are very, very different species. And I like that a lot of them are kind of insectoid as well, because, you know, you look at the variety of insect life on, or arthropod life on this planet, and it makes sense that, you know, insectoid life would evolve.
Numerically, it's the dominant life form.
Absolutely, yeah. And I also like that it's not just one species for one position. Like, they do vary in the positions that they occupy on the football field. I think it would have been kind of boring if, like, all the humans had been quarterbacks or all the heavy G had been in one position. I like that they vary. Like, it's not just each species has its own position that only it can play. I think that was really interesting.
With the exception of the Scorno for the first couple books, at least. Yeah, it's a nice thing they do in that book, because other human sports and I have been kind of spread. Like, humans, quote, gift the universe in this case is their many different athletic sports. And other species kind of, they get into it, they really enjoy it. And soccer, or as the rest of the world calls it, football, has become completely dominated by the Scorno because they're so fast, nothing can touch them, and you're not going to be able to beat a Scorno in soccer or football, so they're the only ones that play it now. But yeah. With the American football, many other species can be a part of it, which makes for a very nice, eclectic group of characters.
I also really like that the species that has taken over the universe, that is ruling, at least in the first book, are just these fucking tiny little bat things that happen to have better technology and a better attitude. Well, not a better, but a more dominant attitude to war than the others.
Yeah.
Not even that. They just had numbers. They would just drop billions of their soldiers onto a planet and through sheer force of numbers take over. And because there's so many of them and they don't give a shit about the lives of their own soldiers, you can't beat them.
Well, I thought it was interesting that because their lifespans are so short, it's not even that. It's just that the concept of life and death there are very different to a species with a drastically shorter lifespan.
Mm-hmm.
And that breed in such high numbers as well. Like, I thought that was fascinating. Like, how would a sentient creature that is an R strategist as opposed to a K strategist, so they have lots of kids as opposed to taking care of one or two, how would, you know, the concept of life be in that sort of species? I thought that was a fascinating kind of thing to explore.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of brings me to what about this world makes the world itself and the creatures so interesting. Like what Scott mentioned in his episode when he joined us for Slither, he has his Rolodex of Awesome, where he consults experts in these various fields to try to make these creatures or the various science fiction aspects of his works, quote, realistic. So, like, kind of like I said the other week with Carnosaur, instead of taking a little bit and making it just a little bit past what we actually know, don't do what Carnosaur does and just go 20 yards past what you know. But all of these creatures are not, they are made up. He made these up when he was in school as a young man, but they're all just a step removed from what we already know, or they follow the protocols established by what we know with evolutionary theory and how the origin of species occur. So it works within a realistic evolutionary history. They all come from different planets, which experience different selection pressures, so it makes sense why these things look different, why they act different, and why they have these different physiological abilities and or characteristics. I'm very much a sucker for any kind of galactic civilization where you have humans living with other species, and like Sam's point earlier, unlike Star Trek or Doctor Who, these aren't just humanoids with blue skin, though those do exist in this world, but they're still humans. Yeah. They just have different color skin. And like Sam was saying about the American football positions, it's nice that you have other species be part of this. And a big theme of this book is that because of American football, racism and intergalactic war has been somewhat put on a hold because these species are actually working with one another. They're living with one another. If you and a Scorno, this crazy 9-foot-tall grasshopper looking thing, are both fans of the same team, there's a common theme. There's a common interest between the two of you, and you can see each other as similar and not just alien species, which is a big part of the wars that were going on in this world before the Galactic Football League came around.
It's a little bit bread and circuses though as well.
What do you mean?
The bread and circuses, you know, like the Roman thing of like, give them bread and circuses and they'll stop thinking about revolting against
us. Yeah. Yes, very much so. Yeah, the Kretorakians keep it around to keep the masses entertained because it's a blood sport. Yep. It's very brutal. Not too dissimilar from actual American football where they talk about CTE and concussions, all the damage it does to these players. But I don't think it's happened yet to my knowledge, but in this universe, players do die on the field occasionally from the sheer brutality of this sport because of how much bigger, stronger, and faster these athletes have become. Yeah. As far as why this makes a good movie or TV series, there's just a shit ton of content to mine in this world. Even just all of Scott's books are connected. We talked about that on the episode he joined us for, but specifically the Galactic Football League itself and that time period around those stories has... I think there are 6 main books right now in the series, plus 4 novellas, and then a bunch of other stuff that is not directly the Galactic Football series, but it takes place in that same area. So lots of fun characters, a lot of plot lines, and I think there is a little bit of something for just about everybody. Cheesy action, you got sports, aliens, some crime, space stuff. It's a lot of fun.
I hate American football. Like, I'm not a big fan of watching it, and I still enjoyed this book. Hmm. So... you don't have to like football to read it.
As far as how I'd like to see this adapted, the options we have are then TV series, a movie, or a comedy thriller type thing. I think the best way for this universe to come onto a screen would be as a series. So because there's just so much to do, you're not going to be able to squeeze this all into one movie or even just a series of movies unless you had a connected, a universe like the MCU. But I think these movies should be in the same vein as the Marvel movies. There's so much out there. It's galaxy spanning, much like the Guardians of the Galaxy aspect of it, where all these fantastical different things that humans are not maybe used to seeing, especially those that can't travel to other planets to play this game against aliens. But there's serious aspects of it. There's a lot of comedy. There's some sadness. So, but it's also written from a young adult point of view. So much like the Marvel movies, it will apply to... I think they're calling 4 quadrant movies: kids, young adults, adults, and older people. I don't know what the 4 quadrants are, but everybody can watch it. It's not limited to a more adult audience. Last but not least, as far as the only thing I think that we want to change to fit the format for a modern audience, the female characters in this series need a lot of work. Many of them are nothing more than a sexualized stereotype of a femme fatale, not even a fatale, just this is a hot woman who's hot because she's hot and she's a woman, so that's what you got.
There are literally no women in the first book, not one.
Yeah, I was gonna say, going along with that, most, even this series as a whole, most of the main characters and villains are male. If there are female characters, they don't really get that much time, so it's very male centric. Though, wrapping up on a positive note with my compliment sandwich, I will say that that Scott does a really good job of including people of color and queer representation in the series.
Cool.
Yeah, I don't like football. I hate Quentin Barnes as a character, but I have to admit that the world, and you're right, it has to be a TV series because you want to see all these planets in detail. Mm-hmm. You can't have something like, the Doctor Strange movie where you're just going through three different universes. You want to see all these planets. And my only complaint with the first movie when it came to understanding those worlds is that we didn't get enough time on them. Thinking back to Libby's comments when we did the Harry Potter movies. No, not the Harry Potter movies, the Fantastic Beasts movies. That world building was hinted at. And it was, but I kind of wanted to spend more time on each planet and learn more about how that civilization works. I thought that would have been fascinating. So absolutely, giving a TV series like even 5 or 6 seasons to this, you could cover so much stuff.
Easy. It could easily be a 10 plus series, a 10 plus season long series. Hmm. There's just so much. Plus, it's the history of the world. He does a really good job of having interstitials between each one of the chapters, which are excerpts from like the fictionalized history books of that galaxy and the different wars that happen between the species or how a species spread from one group to another, from one planet or one region of the galaxy to another.
Do you think that this could be done with anything less than a massive budget?
I would say, unless it was animated, absolutely not. These, to your point earlier, these are not human in a suit type monsters. They have vastly different biologies than any human ever could, not only in the size, but simply the structure. The Kee have 6 legs and 4 arms. Their body is built like a centipede. with half of it horizontal, half of it is vertical, and they have eyes that go all around their head with a weird hole mouth and vocal tubes coming out the top of
their
head.
Like a hexagonal mouth, right?
Yeah, it's a hexagon, their mouth. It's very different than anything we see on our planet. So this would have to be animated or have an enormous budget for CGI.
Yeah, but I think it could work well with like an Invincible style animation.
That's my thought exactly.
Look what they need to mimic a fraction of our power.
So the book that I would love to see adapted, and it's not so much movie monsters or alien races or anything like that, is called The Wind-Up Girl. It's written by very much a sci-fi fantasy writer, Paolo Bacigalupi. Like I said, very much a sci-fi fantasy writer, but this is a very kind of, I think you call it low sci-fi when it's very believable. It's a book that's set in 23rd century Thailand, and it's an apocalyptic, post-apocalyptic world in some senses, but not really. So I guess I'd call it a pseudo during apocalyptic world.
Yeah, like slightly dystopic.
Yeah, it's definitely dystopian. It's absolutely dystopian. And potentially you can see the apocalypse is in progress, but not in the country it's set, not in Thailand. There's two main reasons that the world is so terrible. One is climate change. We're in the 23rd century. It's 200 years in the future. The oceans have risen. The Netherlands no longer exists, along with a lot of coastline around the world. It's incredibly hot all the time. Fossil fuels have completely run out. Energy technology is just about finding more efficient springs. So a spring is essentially a battery that bikers machine power, a bit like what we assume is happening in that early episode of Black Mirror.
Yeah.
And it's energy, like there's no cars anymore. At one point, there's a car and everybody around it is just looking at it with disgust. And the people in it are just like, this is so inefficient. This is disgusting. How could people have ever ridden these? And the second reason is what we talked about before, I think last year when we looked at Okja. Genetic modification has run rampant. So the world over, you've got genetically modified crops everywhere controlled by these massive corporations, very thin allegories for Monsanto, called the Calorie Companies.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, absolutely. And these crops, as Adam was talking about last year, they drift over into different fields. They take up root there, and then these farmers who have done nothing whatsoever get sued for using crops that have been patented by these enormous companies.
For intellectual property theft.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what happens. And not only that, but these new crops are sterile because the calorie companies have made them sterile so that at the end, at the start of every growing season, the farmers have to go and purchase the seeds from the companies. Yeah. So they're essentially holding world security hostage the world over. Crops, on top of this, one of the genuine concerns with GMO crops is that they will lead to essentially super diseases. And that's happened in this world. You have things called red fungus that have just sprung up and wiped out crops in massive batches everywhere because you have such enormous monocultures of these crops.
Okay.
So that's happened the world over. Thailand is one of the last places that's held out against these companies, against all these calorie companies and against climate change. They built enormous seawalls when they saw this was happening. And so Bangkok is protected by this sort of thing. That might lead you to think that it's okay, but it's really fucking not. Thailand is already a really, really hot country.
Yep.
It's along the equator. It's a very warm part of the world. And on top of that, because of the nature of how the rest of the world is, refugees have flooded into Thailand. So the area is incredibly overpopulated and overheated. Refugees are treated as massive second-class citizens. So there's a lot of social dynamics in this that are just completely horrible. On top of that, genetic modification of animals has taken place as well. So one man decided to design a Cheshire cat from Alice in Wonderland genetically for his kid. So basically a smarter version of normal domestic cats that can use chromatophores from cuttlefish to disguise itself and make itself invisible. Naturally, this cat wiped out all domestic cats along with most small animals and birds.
No
well.
Shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's megadonts too, which are exactly the same as what we're trying to do with mammoths at the moment in resurrecting a larger coated African elephant. And there are also genetically modified humans. So there are wind-ups, which are kind of somewhat akin to the replicants from Blade Runner, but somehow treated much, much worse than the replicants.
Jesus.
So the Cheshire cats that I mentioned before, and the wind-ups are seen as not having any souls, so you can pretty much do to them whatever you want.
Lovely.
So even in Thailand, this world is horrible. The reason that Thailand's doing okay is because they hired genetic editors to keep all these genetic strains out and keep all the diseases out. So they just burn enormous crop fields as soon as they find even small traces of this. They're protected, like I said, by a massive seawall as well. So Thailand is holding out against the rest of the world, but there's always this kind of feeling within the government of how long is this going to last. So that's the world you're looking at. The reason I think that this is so interesting and this would make such a good TV series, I'll talk about why it should be a TV series, you could do it as a movie later, is my question to you three, does anything I just described sound unrealistic?
No.
Not in the least.
That's the thing. None of this is crazy at all. This is stuff that is probably going to happen in some parts of the world. It's a bit comparable to Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale, in that a lot of the stuff she portrays is already happening in different parts of the world, but it's just all put together in one place and it's horrifying. That's what this is. All the things we've talked about, climate change, rising sea levels, corrupt companies like Monsanto dominating markets and forcing farmers out of business. It's all stuff that's happening, but it's just happened the world over and it's all crammed into one area. And it's a horrifying look at how this world could be and very well could become. And this is set in the 23rd century, but it's not unlikely that this could happen by the end of this one. And we need more dystopian climate change media. We've got things like Mad Max, but that's well in the future. That's kind of outside our range of credibility because it's so far away. What else have we had recently? We've had
Love, Death, and Robots. That's another. Off and on.
Love, Death, and Robots. There was another one.
The Book of Eli was also post-apocalyptic.
The Road?
Yeah, The Road.
The Road as well. We have these movies that are set where you've had biological catastrophe that's led to this sort of thing. But we've had nothing that is much closer and more realistic to what the world would actually go through and is starting to go through. And I think in a world where we are becoming a lot more attuned to the realities of climate change, this would be a really horrifying shot in the arm for us.
Yeah, I feel like I have not read this book. I hadn't actually heard of it before until you mentioned it for this episode of the podcast. But reading your summary for this and then also hearing you explain it right now, it's like, yeah, that's what's going to happen not too long from now, probably, minus maybe the fake humans.
I was going to say, there's a scene in the beginning of the book that I was reading about one of the main characters eating like a fruit. I think it's a fruit for the first time and it has like so much flavor and you just get the immediate sense of like, oh, this is a very, very bleak world. If like something as small as a bite of fruit is just like immensely pleasurable.
What one of the main characters is just trying to do is figure out how Thailand has brought back a lot of these fruits that were wiped out by these genetically modified diseases. And Thailand has this enormous seed bank and they've hired these genetic editors from overseas to come and bring these crops back to life. Wow. But there's the looming threat of these calorie companies always being able to come in and just ruin all their work. So,
yeah.
I think, like I said, I think this would make a good... It could be a TV series, but I think you could do this in a movie. I think you could lay the world out well enough in a two-hour movie. It's a really great cautionary tale. It's a really interesting setting as well. Like, we don't normally think of these movies as taking place in Southeast Asia, but Thailand at the moment, I mean, it's already going through these changes. So I think you'd be able to get the Thai government on board pretty easily. We love political machinations. There is a really interesting conflict between the environment and the trade ministry in this, which is kind of like a caricature of between corporate interests and fundamentalist environmentalists as well. But I think it's done really well. There's lots of gruesome deaths in this too. And there's just a lot of horrible people. And I think if Game of Thrones proved everything, is that we like gruesome deaths and a lot of horrible people.
Yeah.
We're enjoying this kind of mid-apocalyptic movie these days. We've seen things like Westworld and The Handmaid's Tale, where the world's going to shit, but not quite total shit. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so I think I would ideally like to see it in an 8-episode, like one-off series. So just like a mini-series or something like that. I think it could do it really well. And the good thing with this is that the budget doesn't need to be that big. Like, you have those creatures, the Megadons and the Cheshire Cats. You could put a little bit of CGI into them. But there's no overt need for massive special effects here. It's just a really horrible world. And I have been to, not to shit on Southeast Asia, but I have been to a lot of places where you just need to film this in summer and get more people and just make the streets a little grimier. And you've got some of the settings that this book would need in translation to visual media.
Yeah, I mean, you're just like taking Neil Blomkamp, taking all of his movies and shooting them in the slums of Johannesburg. Like, this is what it could look like in the future, potentially.
District 9. Yeah, that's District what I was 9. Thinking of. Very similar yeah. vibes.
District 9, Elysium.
Elysium is a great example because, I mean, yeah, like you said, it's shot in the slums of Johannesburg, but, and he didn't need to do that much more work to make it look a bit more futuristic.
Nope. Yeah?
So you could very easily do that in some of these parts of the world. In terms of what you'd need to change from the source material, if you were going to translate this into for today's audience, there is a main female character that's a wind-up, and she goes through some really horrific shit. I mean, I said earlier that, you know, they're treated as worthless, that you can do whatever you want to them. But even to that point, like, some of the things that she's put through in the book, I don't think would translate well to TV. I don't think this is a problem. If anybody's watched The Boys, there is a lot of horrific shit that happens in the comics that they kind of pare back on a lot.
Or don't show at all.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't make The Boys any less horrifying. It's just that they have, you know, rolled back some of the more visceral, horrifying stuff that happens there. So I think you could still tell her tale in a really horrifying way, but not have some of the more visceral things that she has to go through on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And there are no good people in this at all. And I think you at least need to have one or two characters that you sympathize with
yeah.
in a TV yeah. series.
You do.
Like, they can't just all be assholes. Some of them have redemptive arcs. Some of them start off good and then you realize that they're kind of dicks along the way. But I think you just need to have somebody who you're rooting for the whole time.
Yep.
Yeah. I'm a hero. I'm holding out
for a hero till the end of the night. So my book is actually a comic series called ElfQuest, and it's written by a couple, Wendy and Richard Pini. I always want to say Panini when I see the word for whatever reason. Yes, yeah, so Wendy and Richard Panini. In 1978, they're also known as Warp.
The Peenies.
Yes, they're also known as Warp because they put their little anagram of their initials together.
That's really cool.
Publishing company. Yeah. Brief summary of the overall series is a group of elves called the Wolf Riders are at war with human beings. Using fire, the human village decides to burn down the entire forest in a vengeful, not very well thought out move. They succeed in driving the elves out because there's no fucking forest left. The Wolf Riders, who, yes, have wolves and can communicate telepathically with them, as well as with each other, flee to the underground for aid from the trolls. Trolls in this world are very greedy and malicious by nature. They trick the Wolf Riders into wandering into a barren desert, thinking that they'll perish. The Wolf Riders instead discover a group of elves called Sunfolk. And so for the first time, the Wolf Riders and the Sunfolk realize that there are more elves out there. The Wolf Riders leader, his name is Cutter. He decides to go on a quest to find all of the lost and separated groups of elves and find out what happened to them. Like, why are they so separated? And the world is essentially Earth with two moons and some surviving prehistoric megaflora and megafauna. They travel through several biomes, forest, desert, underground, open tundra, and up in the tippy tops of a huge mountain range. So that's kind of the brief synopsis. I didn't want to give away too much, so...
I really did not like the artwork in this.
It took me a while getting used to it.
The tiny but buff bodies.
Yes.
Very like, oh, I don't know what's going on here. Yeah.
I did think it. And so, yeah, what Sam's talking about is I thought it was interesting in this that they didn't make elves Lord of the Ring elves or like traditional like D&D elves. Yeah. They're, you know, short little people. They do have pointed ears, but they're not tall, like fair haired, slim, like what you kind of think of when you think of elves in media nowadays.
Yeah, and there's no, like, ethereal wisdom about them either, which I like. Mm-hmm. Although, I think it's implied that that was the case before they came to the planet.
Yeah, right? That's part of the plot. There's definitely not in the main group. They find more and more about their heritage and how that was sort of lost with time. So, for me, what makes this world and, like, the creatures in it so interesting, I think for me it was really interesting to see it's basically early humans mixed with a more developed race and how that can play out. So you have the elves, and not all of them do, but even within the wolf riders, you know, they have this telepathic ability to communicate with themselves and with wolves, like as animals. So you have certain abilities and technologies that are very advanced and powerful, but they don't have the numbers, whereas humans do, even though they're a little bit more primitive. And so it kind of makes this nice balance of power, and I think that that's really interesting. I would love to see how Two Moons affects Earth. I really wonder what that can or can't do with fucking up tidal pools and things like that. They have some really interesting abilities. Obviously, telepathy is one, but they also have something called recognition. And recognition acts like a biological signal. So it's when one parent... So it's like when one parent recognizes another parent, and all that means is that those two people will be guaranteed to produce an offspring that is superior to both sets of parents. The parents can then choose to become life mates or just go their separate ways after the offspring is produced. So they very much describe it in the series as this like pull or biological draw that they cannot refuse. But after they have a kid, it's just kind of like whatever you want to do. So it's very much like
it's really an interesting form of sexual selection.
Yeah, yeah. There's also this little fairy creature called a preserver, and they fly around and shoot like a gossamer type web from their mouths, and it encases their victims in like a stasis. It's not a permanent stasis, because eventually I think you do like die of starvation, but it's just very interesting, and they're very funny creatures.
is that like the big fucking spider Shelob in the third Lord of the Rings thing?
Yeah, it's more of like they put him into like a sleep and less of like a paralyzation. And they do it for not just creatures or like organisms. They do it for like whole areas of a forest as well. So they'll put like trees or plants into the stasis as well. I think this would make a really good TV series. I think you could really showcase the different species and the storylines all like have a really good arc to it. There's plenty of really well-developed characters, anti-heroes, and even sympathetic villains. Like it's part epic fantasy where you get like the big quest and the journey through the land. It's got a lot of humor in it, sort of like buddy-buddy style. And then part tragedy, you do have some really, really tragic deaths in there that you're just like, no, I did not want that character to die. Plus you have romance, you have dope magic, and you have some really epic battle scenes.
Cool.
Production-wise, what do you think this would need? Would this have to be animated, like the comics
themselves? Yeah, so I immediately wrote that this would make a fantastic animated series. Similar, but not quite as dark as Castlevania, was my thought.
Ooh. Ah, okay. From what little I know about these comics and the art direction, I could absolutely see that comparison there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How about the Dark Crystal style?
It fits more the art style of the comics.
Puppets the entire time?
Maybe.
Just Muppets.
Oh, God. Yeah. Please, no. But yeah, I think that it has, like I said, it has an interesting sort of arc with how they're dealing with the different races surviving with each other, not just with humans and elves, but elves and trolls, and then preservers as a creature as well. I think it does a really good job of being more inclusive, especially for elves and especially for 40 years ago, which is when it was written. So you do have a lot of like pretty prominent female characters that are badasses as well. And then you have some male characters who are atypical roles, like a little bit more
beta males,
soy boys.
Yeah, like more in a supportive role. Yeah.
Simps.
Than you would see. They're not all just, yeah, they're big simps. So yeah, the only thing I would change, well, there's two things. I think obviously adding a bit more diversity, they do a pretty good job. The some folk are definitely give off a lot of Middle Eastern vibes, and they make them look that way as well. So they're not, like I said, they're not all fair haired. They're not all blue eyed elves. There could be a bit more. There is also a gratuitous orgy scene that I felt was a little unnecessary. maybe that makes some of you want to read it more. I don't know.
Which issue? If it was to go live action, would you just do the kind of Lord of the Rings where you separate the different races just by aesthetic alone?
I don't know. That's a good question. I really like that they're different from the typical elves, but I don't know how you would necessarily do that other than just like the pointy ears kind of thing.
Hmm. Would you go with Castlevania style of animation as well?
I think so. I mean, maybe I'm just biased because I really enjoyed the Castlevania series. Good. But I think that it has similar tones. There is a lot of darkness in it, and there is a lot of like underlying sadness to like basically this race that is sort of dying out. And I think that it might mesh well. There are parts of it where you definitely need to be a little brighter and sunnier than Castlevania.
Yeah, it's a dark show.
They have a fantastic villain in this though, and it's a woman and she's fucking awesome.
Okay, just for not related, but what issue is that orgy in?
That's issue number 69.
Nice.
I think if it was a TV series, you could confine it to about 3 seasons. It's not necessarily that like there's that much, you know, like with Adam's book, how there's just so many worlds to explore. It's not that they explore that many areas, which they kind of do. But I think it's more about the length of the quest that he goes on and kind of all the stuff that happens to lead up to this big, like, final couple battles. I think that really is what makes the book a lot of fun and interesting and dynamic. And so you would need all that to incorporate it.
Comet Castle falls. Samson Cyberblood is the new king of the star system. Long live Space Shire 7 and long live the Hyperspeed Throne.
The series that I was wanting to do would be the Kingkiller Chronicles. But I mean, specifically to start, would just be talking about the very first book, which is The Name of the Wind.
Heard of it.
So the storyline basically follows our lead protagonist, who is telling the story back from his bar kind of past his golden days, kind of in the midst of a war and kind of very disillusioned with the world and disillusioned with the actions of his youth. And he's kind of retelling how he ended up there and kind of his journey, which is, it's quite a wind through sort of original troop behaviors and kind of a fun childhood that ends with, I don't want to give too much away, but basically family murder, Batman style, through a stint of like homelessness. And it's just his character is kind of, he's kind of always scrabbling to make it work. And I think that's what I enjoyed the most about this series, and particularly the first book, is there isn't that redemption series of like, or cycle where he hits something and suddenly everything works out for him. The king is now his friend and everybody gives him what he wants. He's always scrabbling for the next chunk of money for his next housing. And he screws up a lot. There are these actions that take place in the book where he screws something up and you're like, oh, well, that's okay. Like, he'll fix that a couple of chapters later. And just because of the way that humans work, you're still dealing with that into the second book where you're like, oh, come on, they're not going to forgive him for that. And it's like, no, that's not the way life
works.
Why
wouldn't they?
I also really enjoy magic. The way they do magic in the book, as the name kind of implies, The Name of the Wind, is that magic is really hard. To do it, you have to not only have a scientific mastery, so you need to have certain devices or runes or situations put in place that allow you to carry these situations out, but you also need to have complex training.
I like universes where magic is hard.
Same.
Like, it's not just, you know, swish and flick, Leviosa. Like, I like it where you really have to put years in and it's very fucking difficult and people still don't master it correctly.
Here, children, walk around school with these explosive devices that definitely won't be a problem when you, an 11-year-old, has the ability to literally kill your classmates at any second.
In terms of the creatures, there is a whole selection of different species in this. And Sam, I am going to ruin this for you, but you are going to love this creature as we go through it. Midway through the first book, our lead character encounters a Dracus. A Dracus is a large herbivorous reptilian creature, and it's known for the ability to breathe fire. Its diet consists of trees. And basically what it does is it'll go over, it chomps and mushes, and then uses its fire to break down the trees such that it can digest them. They are not a species that reproduces very frequently, and their numbers are fairly low, and they're where the legend of the dragon has come from. They consume a fairly large amount of iron into their diet, which allows them to have fairly strong iron-based scales, but they grow really, really slowly. These organisms are very old, which is another reason why there's so few of them. They hate fire, so it's actually a little bit of an interesting point in the story. They move towards fire because fire burns down trees, their food source, and they're well known as actually a creature that's important, and their absence taken away leads to an increase in forest fires. And there's something that Cavalte talks about, and he's like, humans are so afraid of these creatures, and yet they don't realize that they're one of the species that's actually really important for keeping forest fire numbers to a low area, and that villages that... Villages that often kill off their Dracuses will then experience forest fires, and they'll be like, oh, we don't know what's caused this. And it's like, you did this. Like, you killed off something that was having nothing to do with you. Now, the one that he encountered...
Backburning, essentially.
The one that he encounters in the story gets extra sad because basically he can't figure out why this organism is getting so close to humans. It's moving in close to the villages, and he's like, normally they stay away, and it's also acting erratically. And what he ends up finding out kind of near the midpoint of the book is that there are a group of people in the forest that are basically mining a type of heroin that you can get off a certain type of sap, and they've accidentally been leaving this substance out. And our Dracus has been getting into it, and our Dracus has now become horribly addicted. And it's moving closer and closer towards villages where it thinks it can get more of the fix going forward.
Poor thing.
Mm-hmm. Leading to a situation in which first he tries to overdose the Dracus, basically gathering a huge amount of this material, totally forgetting that since it's consuming burnt trees, it consumes large amounts of charcoal, allowing for the effects to basically be delayed and just give this thing actually much more of a high. And then finally leading to a situation in which he needs to trick it under an old iron wheel and then drop an iron wheel onto this creature, something that he's really upset with. And then his actions of saving the town and rewarding it for something that the humans have been brought on is a group of local villagers that gather around the creature basically after it's dead, stabbing and desecrating the body because they believe that they're killing a demon or a monster.
It sounds like what The Witcher should be.
Yeah.
The TV series. I know there's more to the books, yeah.
Yeah, it's similar to what the books are in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that, like, that concept of familiarization, like animals getting way too comfortable with humans and then that becoming a problem is, yeah, it's awful. Like, we see it with fucking bears all the time. If people are like, oh, look at the bear, it's coming up to the picnic table. No, that's a familiarized bear is going to be a fucking dead bear. Right.
Anyway,
it's not understanding the animal. People get out of their cars at Yellowstone all the time and go take a picture with the bison. That thing is 1,000 kilograms. It will kill you in a second. Why would you get anywhere close to that? It is literally twice the size of your car. What are you thinking?
In terms of or why this would make a great movie TV series, exactly as you guys were pointing out, I enjoy showing the reality of things being hard, requiring study, requiring time, not giving children exactly devices that allow them to turn back time or literally kill one another if they can pronounce Avada Kedavra correctly. Like
Sam just died. Listeners.
Or if you can pronounce it incorrectly, apparently, because fucking Voldemort.
Or not say it at all and just point a wand.
The book
Did you put your name in the goblet of fire?
The book also features really realistic accounts of academia. as it gets through. Like, there's a whole process. You have to pay to get in, to get knowledge, to get access to the library, and different people, depending on who their family is or where their background is, can be affected by different charges, different costs, and have different powers within the university, regardless of how good or bad a student they might be. And plays around a lot with the concept of the overconfident scientist, the person who shows up, who we've all run into, who's like, I'm hot shit. But if they don't have the training or the background, quickly get their ass burned.
Yeah, there was, correct me if I'm wrong, because it's been a couple years since I read this book, but there's like a scene with this, I think it's pronounced Scrail. Basically, somebody thinks that they can like take him on, and then they get completely overrun. They're just like, oh, fuck.
Yeah, he does. And the character makes all of these bad decisions throughout it. In terms of how I would like to see it adapted, I would love a TV series. If you actually did a good job of Wheel of Time, and we ended up in a situation where you could have basically The Name of the Wind as this sort of stretching series that would have to go on, what would need to change about the source material to fit the format? And this kind of leads me into my last point. As much as I absolutely adore this book, and I would love to see a series, it will not and should not ever happen. There's so much of this book that is long and doesn't go anywhere, but is needed for our understanding of the character. There is so much darkness and depression. There are entire chapters that take place of him just trying to feed like a couple kids and keep them going because they're homeless on the street. And he doesn't have anything, but he's also trying to make it work. Stuff that really feeds our character, but wouldn't translate well into an understanding of the show. Modern audiences like to see explosions and changes, and they like a plot that moves along at a much higher pace. I don't think that this would work. It also wouldn't work, and I struggled through the book until I finally got into the routine of accepting the fact that this character's mistakes were realistic and would follow him. There are fight scenes where you get super excited to see your character go up against someone, and he gets the shit kicked out of him. Or he ends up with damage and you're like, oh my God, they chopped off his finger, but it's okay. I mean, I know it's reduced the ability to do that magic spell that I really liked, but he'll like grow the finger back or something like that. And no, he just loses it. He can't do that spell anymore, or he just can't do that operation. And you're like, no, fireball. I want fireball.
But fireball.
And there are points that go on, and these long implications that lead to chronic disease, chronic pain, change that aren't recoverable from. It was my favorite part of the book, and it's the reason I know it would never translate onto the screen. Those aren't the heroes we like
to
see.
I really think that you can condense that sort of, you know, character development and backstory into a TV series. I don't think you necessarily need all of it.
You just need a good writer and not somebody who decides you need a whole season's worth of setup just to then get to the beginning of the actual story in the second season.
What I want to ask is, how would you want to see it told? Because we've talked in copious amounts on this podcast about how much we hate fucking constant flashbacks, right? But this entire book is told as a flashback. Would you bother with the bar scene that happens in the first 100 pages, or would you just dive straight into
it? So the bar scene continues all the way through both books, where basically we interlude
back. I know, but it is a framing device initially.
I really enjoy it. And I enjoy that it gives us this realistic of, we snap back to this older character, and it kept me grounded for basically like, and I think it would for the show as well, where you move through and you're just like, oh, you know, he's going to like turn out to be a total badass, or I can't wait to see. And then it just goes to like the tiny little tavern that he runs with his broken sword. As he's kind of like, ugh, magic has hurt me in ways that you'll never imagine. And you're like, no, but things were going great for you. What are you doing? I really would want that same thing to exist.
Well, I mean, like, that's like The Princess Bride did that, right? Like, it's this whole framework of the kid and telling the story and then going back, and they kind of interrupt it throughout. And I think it worked great.
Yeah, and I'd like to see that done again.
What did Fezzik mean, he's dead? I mean, he didn't mean dead. Was this only faking, right?
You want me to read this or not?
So after that riveting foray into the literary world, we're going to be returning next week with another cinematic classic, or maybe not a classic, it's something I never heard of until about a month ago, a movie from 2014 called Exists. and we'll finally be dipping our toe into that stinky, furry Bigfoot water. But join us for that next week. And remember, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Bye.
Bye.
That's me.
That was you.
I'm ready to go home now.
Ooh.
I mean, we're ready.